Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. It is Tuesday, December 30th. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. This morning we hear about the crackdown on illegal fireworks as we prepare to ring in the new year and remember the disastrous explosion that killed six people. What prosecutors are saying about the ongoing investigation. Arrests have been made, but no one has been charged. We learn more about the relationships between the victims of the fireworks disaster and the experience for our first responders. And we revisit a conversation with a drone light show operator that we had earlier this year. He tells us what goes on behind the scenes to make it all happen. We remember a local tree lover who loomed large in the field of urban planning. Plus, we check in with one of the creative forces behind Awana. The Waikiki-based Cirque du Soleil show marks 1 year of performances. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Just don't do it. Those are the words of caution issued by city and state officials yesterday at a news conference discussing fireworks. Honolulu Mayor Rick Mangiardi convened the conference to remind the public of tougher fireworks laws in the wake of a deadly explosion last New Year's Eve. HPR's Mark Liddell attended the conference, and we hear first from Mayor Rick Mangiardi.
Six people died. 36 people were severely injured. 17 were in intensive care. 36 went to the hospital. Those people have been scarred forever. Those families have been changed forever. You know, it's one thing to have, from my standpoint, a memory of something like that, as tragic as it was, as horrific as it was. Those people are still living with it and will continue to do so. That's something we never thought would happen, and we certainly never want to have happen again, which is why we're here today and assembled. And so from a leadership standpoint, I've really wrestled about what's the message? How do we convince people that this is no longer a cultural practice? I know the cultural practices. There are illegal fireworks that you can set off and do, but there's nothing cultural or legal about aerial fireworks. And the potential for widespread damage and death and severe injury is very real, as we all witnessed. So we're here today to somewhat beg, somewhat plead, to try to influence people to the best of our ability, and at the same time talk about the laws that we've changed and what we plan on doing about that, because we cannot tolerate that ever again. There will be no excuse. There's no understanding. There should be no accident like we all experienced last year, and especially those people who suffered and died from it.
Honolulu Police Department Interim Chief Roddy Vanek discussed the new regulations that are in place that the mayor referenced. He shared that the number of fireworks violations has plummeted this year compared to the same time last year.
So far this year, there were 232 violations from Thanksgiving to the end of this past weekend. That's compared to over 1,200 violations last year. So what that means is earlier this year, there was a call to action for people to not use illegal fireworks. For those of you who have heard that call for action, thank you. 232 compared to over 1,200 last year, people are listening. So for those of you who are doing your part, thank you very much. But we still have 232 violations. So there are still those who are not heeding the warning. So for those of you, please, again, stop doing it. It's illegal. So what can you do if you do hear or see illegal fireworks? Well, call 911. What you need to do is community information is essential to our success. Again, if you see or hear illegal fireworks, call 911, meet with an officer. Providing a written statement and any photos or videos helps. Although you can remain anonymous, a witness who is willing to cooperate is the most effective. I know a lot of times it's very hard to, you know, snitch on your neighbor, but when you meet with an officer, we can take the information we need, we can get a video, we can say, hey, that's the individual who did it. We can issue a citation. You can see here, if you commit an illegal act, which it is, and aerial fireworks are illegal. Now, under the new laws, we can issue a citation, like if you run a red light or if you're speeding. Before, you needed to go to court. Now we can issue a $300 citation. If you use illegal fireworks and you cause any type of injury to someone, if it's serious or substantial bodily injury, or if it causes their death, you will go to jail for a very long time. So again, do not use illegal fireworks. They are illegal. They can hurt or kill someone. We will be out there in force. We will be enforcing. So do your part. We're asking for your assistance.
And Deputy City Prosecutor Scott Bell answered questions about the investigation into the Eliumanu explosion. Despite 12 arrests, no one has been charged.
So as a division chief at the Honolulu Prosecutor's Office, I'm overseeing the Honolulu Prosecutor's Office investigation into the events of that evening. Working collaboratively with the Honolulu Police Department, my office has looked at all evidence amassed by law enforcement investigators. This includes scores of interviews, gigabytes of electronic data, and other information. As we look at this case, I'd like to just remind you of a couple of principles that are really important, and Director Lambert touched upon it. As a general matter, it's the prosecutor's discretion of who to charge, when to charge, and what charges to bring. Generally, we don't foreshadow or give a heads up of when we're going to charge for obvious reasons, to avoid the flight of the suspects, intimidation of witnesses, and the destruction of evidence. I can say that the investigation is ongoing. Working collaboratively with the investigator headed by HPD's homicide detail, the prosecution has amassed an incredible amount of information. Once the investigation is complete, we'll apply it to the law as it existed on December 31, 2024, not as written currently, and bring all charges, the most severe ones, that can be proven in court beyond a reasonable doubt. I can say, as a general matter, what we have found to be shocking, if not startling, is the refusal to cooperate by the family, friends, and acquaintances of the deceased and the injured. Surely under circumstances such as this, any fair-minded person would be willing to cooperate. But what we have seen is a lack of cooperation, half-truths, misinformation, and complete information that's contradicted by the reliable facts. So those have been stumbling blocks, but not insurmountable ones, to this prosecution, the refusal to cooperate by those with direct knowledge of the offense. While arrests have been made, they have been released pending investigation, and it'll be the time of the prosecution's choosing when the charges are brought. I commend the investigators at the Honolulu Police Department, specifically the detectives of the homicide detail, who have worked tirelessly for months. The question is, why not now? Why, after a year, have charges not been brought? Again, without disclosing means, methods, and procedures, law enforcement is waiting the completion of certain steps before an informed decision can be made. And it's no one's fault, but rather speaks to our careful and methodical approach so that we're not going off half-cocked, but rather the charges will be proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
We have been listening to officials warning about the dangers of illegal fireworks and the new regulations in place to help law enforcement take action against scofflaws. The officials spoke yesterday at a news conference convened by the mayor of Honolulu. And, you know, we've continued to hear from our listeners about their fireworks experiences over the past year. We received this voicemail from a listener on Maui.
Aloha, my name is Claire, calling from Maui. And, you know, we had terrible fires here 2 years ago and are still just reeling from the damage and devastation. I lost my business. And the New Year's and 4th of July fireworks have been very scary for us before and ever since. We had one household in our neighborhood that did a lot of really amazing, astonishingly beautiful aerial illegal fireworks twice a year, but really scary, especially since the Oahu tragedy and the Lahaina fires. A lot of neighbors were scared because we saw flaming large pieces of fireworks debris landing on our homes and cars twice a year. We're very, very grateful to Catherine and the team for all your education around this. And because of that education 6 months ago and Governor Josh Green's increase of penalties, we put letters in the mailboxes of the homes that the households that were doing this and told them that we knew their addresses and now we could report them for very stiff penalties. And they stopped. So it's been very quiet since the governor's new legislation, which I've also called his office and thanked him for. And as we're a week in advance, we're going to put letters in those mailboxes again. And we know that Catherine and her team are saving lives by spreading the education, and very grateful to EMS services and our Maui police. Mahalo and aloha. Have a wonderful, safe season.
You know, we do appreciate the feedback, and yeah, what a powerful thing to do. Leave a note for your neighbor. If you would like to share your thoughts, please leave a voicemail on our talkback line. That number is 808-792-8217. As New Year's Eve approaches, we invite you to record what your neighborhood sounds like. Send us the audio. Email it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and we may play it on the show. You know, this week, Honolulu Civil Beat reconstructed the scene of the New Year's explosion. Reporter Christina Gender joins us with a deep dive on a story about the relationship of the victims. She also mapped out what it was like for the first responders who came to their aid. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning, Catherine. It's good to be here.
Yes, you know, your story really mapped out all those relationships and, you know, set the scene that night. I mean, it was so traumatic.
It was, you know, everything started out beautifully. It was a celebration of family and friends, several dozen people eating food and having a good time, drinking and just partying, and the mood was light. And then everything changed in an instant with this explosion and really has changed these people's lives forever. Six people were killed, including a three-year-old boy and his mother. Many more injured, about two dozen seriously injured, some still recovering to this day with burn injuries, and they had to learn how to walk again and just do daily functions again. And then there's a dozen people that were arrested and have this sort of threat of criminal charges hanging over their heads. So a lot of people are still traumatized by this.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, throughout the year, some of this information, you know, has been out there, but then to see it all come together, it's really powerful when you just see how many family members, you know, were lost or hurt.
Right. The information kind of throughout this year has come out in drips and drabs, and I tried to connect all the dots, and I spoke with first responders who were there and really witnessed this, and even they are kind of struggling with what they saw still today, even though they kind of see difficult things every day. They're still struggling with it. And I kind of went through with them in our interview, okay, take me, you know, minute to minute. What did you see? What did you smell? What did you experience? And they described a war zone. There were people covered in glass, just horrific injuries that honestly I couldn't even describe in written words. People seeing their family members, you know, injured and with these horrifying injuries on the street. It's really, really difficult. And then trying to kind of make a path to recovery. Some of these people, you know, are recovering from their own injuries and then have lost family members or have family members or friends who are arrested. I mean, there's just so much emotionally wrapped up in this tragedy.
Yes, and, you know, we heard from our one listener, you know, on Maui, who talked about the trauma from the Lahaina wildfires. And, you know, you can just feel for the families that are suffering from the post-traumatic stress syndrome. I mean, just hearing the popping noises just, oh my gosh, brings it all back.
Definitely, yeah. I spoke with one neighbor who was about two houses down, and she the force of this explosion was enough to turn on her gas stove, And she said that she, you know, ran out and saw people running for their lives. And today she jumps when she hears, you know, a car backfire or fireworks continuing to go off. And she thinks of the three-year-old that didn't make it every day, she said. But there's also a fear for those that were intimately involved with this incident that everyone who wasn't there doesn't fully understand. And that's what I tried to convey in the story for folks who weren't there. This is how bad it was. You could lose your friends. You could lose your family. And the people that saw it are kind of asking the rest of the islands, is it worth it? You know, we have New Year's coming up tomorrow, New Year's Eve, and people probably have already, you know, bought the things they're going to celebrate with. But that's the question that they want everyone to consider.
Your loved ones. Your digital coverage, you know, includes a video, too, that I hadn't seen before, just of, you know, that neighborhood, the drone video.
Yes. Yeah, you can see the explosion from the sky, and then there's also footage that hasn't been released previously of the first responders coming. You can see the ambulance, the first arriving ambulance and the first arriving fire engine, and they didn't know what they were getting into either. They arrived just thinking they were going to help some injured people, and what they came to was a mass casualty event that was unlike anything they'd seen. You can see footage of those first moments from the sky.
Well, yeah, all very, very powerful reporting and powerful coverage. And if anyone is in doubt about what they plan to do, hopefully they will read your story and will come and change. But thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Christina Jedra. She has a story about the Salt Lake Aliamanu fireworks explosion. Look for it at civilbeat.org. As we reflect on the deadly events of last year's New Year's Eve, we wanted to look back at a story that we aired earlier this year. Could drone light shows be an alternative to illegal aerial fireworks? The Kahala Hotel became the first in Hawaii to experiment with aerial drone shows on New Year's Eve, and this year the practice is expanding to Maui as well. Tyler Hiranaka is the director of operations at Sky Elements Hawaii, which produces the drone light shows. Hiranaka spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender in February about the growing demand for these shows in Hawaii.
During COVID, when we took the hiatus, you know, I'm a non-essential worker, so I had some time and I was looking around and I was like, hey, you know, how come nobody in Hawaii is doing drone light shows? Hawaii is a destination. A lot of people want to come here. There's a lot of conferences that come here. And I was just kind of perplexed as why nobody was pursuing it. Got some of my buddies together. Then I said, hey, if we figure out how to do this, would this be something that you guys would be willing to pursue? And everybody, like Lemming, decided to jump off the cliff with me, and there we went.
Did you have any experience working in drones or doing drone shows before that?
Not at all. I think the first drone light show I saw on TV was the one by Intel. As they were showing what they could do with their chipsets and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, that is the most coolest, amazing thing that I had ever seen. Videos and pictures can't do them justice. They're just so incredible to watch.
And so what goes into creating a drone show in terms of technology and hardware?
For our Hawaii office, you know, our shows are anywhere in the range of like 50 to 300 plus drones. The shows that we've flown on the mainland have been anywhere from like, I think the biggest one they had was 5,000. They broke a Guinness World Record with flying the largest turkey and like a Santa Claus or something like that, which is really cute. But I like that you ask what goes into the show because a lot of people don't understand, you know. A drone light show business is kind of like a production company / engineering firm. You know, we're like an engineering team with a design and creative team. So on the client-facing side, you know, we go through the process, you know, we mock up a storyboard for them to make sure that the story that we're telling for their event is the one that they want so their audience really can feel the drone light show. The production brings so much value to every show that we do, and they're all custom for our clients. After the storyboard, We mock that up so the client can see, oh, what the animation is going to look like, how the pictures are going to look like in the formation that they have with the number of drones that they're going to use. And then we send that off to our creative team to start animating them. And from there, we use a very specialized software for drone light shows that program each drone position in the path, whether it be flying through the shapes and transitions and things like that. So there's a lot of complexity there. Keeping it simple, you know, it's just a really expensive 3D animation software, which is really awesome. Like technology, even 5 years ago when we started that drone program, was not there. And now, you know, with components being a little bit cheaper, well, not too much cheaper, but more accessible, you know, engineers from around the world have been able to specifically build drones for Drone Light Show. And, you know, thus the software, then all the things that came along with it. So before the show comes, on the development side, there's at least maybe like 80 to 100 plus hours on the design side, because it's like we're making our own short. And then, you know, there's the day of production, huge logistical operation, moving hundreds of drones, sometimes thousands of drones, you know, getting our team together on site. For us, when we go to our production, safety is the biggest concern for us. Technology is great. So we get out there early, we do all of our pre-flight safety checks, we set up our grid, we make sure everything's good to go, we troubleshoot everything before we take flight, and drones go up, drones come back down. So
very much an emerging field, but you said you're the only company that does this here in Hawaii, so why do you think that is?
Well, I can tell you on the economic standpoint, the barrier to entry is quite large. You know, it was impossible to get funding for a new business like that because the technology is so new. Nobody understood what it was. And yeah, it was, there's a high barrier to entry, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you make it work?
You know, we had an option to buy a house, and then during the pandemic, we didn't. And, you know, my girlfriend's very patient with me, so bless her soul, now we got drones. But I think it's working out, you know, because like what we originally estimated for our projections on how everything would work out financially and economically and just for Hawaii in general, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity for it, you know. And if people do decide to come into Hawaii for the space, you know, there's a lot of space to grow. Else, you know, my team will happily grow along with the demand should it be there.
And so business has been good so far?
I think any new thing that comes to Hawaii, you know, they always tell us like Hawaii's like the last to figure out the cool stuff. So I wouldn't say that it's been super amazing, but we're definitely on the right track. We have good steady business with our local partners, and you know, we're getting more local partners and more people that are interested. But I think it's just a matter of time when people see how incredible the shows are. You know, you really got to go and see one to understand and appreciate the Drone Light Show. It's just incredible every single time.
And so you did a drone show at Megabon, which was a really big festival. Has that been your biggest event so far?
Megabon was a pretty big event. I think for a public audience, that was definitely our biggest event here. But the most impactful show was the show that we worked on with Downtown Athletic Club of Honolulu with Keith Amamiya and their team over there. We did a drone light show for the Lahaina Luna graduation last year. That show and being at that show and working to produce that show for the community and the kids over there was probably the one of the more incredible things we've ever done, actually. It was just awesome. That show was awesome from start to finish. The goal for that was really just to uplift that community, because as we learned, that particular graduating class, you know, they went into school and then they started with COVID. And then before they went into their senior year, they had the fire over there. So, you know, we had a lot of things based on West Maui, you know, and it was really awesome to do that for them. And surely none of us will ever forget it. It was awesome. The mm-hmm. energy over there that we got from that community is, yeah, it's mm-hmm. pretty awesome.
Are there any specific licenses you need to get to operate?
Yeah, there's a lot of compliance that you do have to follow because we're federally regulated by the FAA. So there's different kind of FAA waivers that you can apply for, and we have ours. And also the individual pilots need their Part 107 licenses to, you know, fly the drones. And even each of our drones are uniquely identified, so they're like little airplanes, even though they're just drones.
Oh,
you won't
gosh.
See us flying over New Jersey, I promise you that. Yeah, everybody will know when we're up in the sky.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people right now are looking for an alternative to fireworks. But when we're thinking about the relative benefits of drone shows compared to a type of entertainment like fireworks, where do things stand on the environmental side, on the side for pets, for noise pollution, all the things that people complain about.
Yeah, so for Hawaii particularly, though, Hawaii people love fireworks. It's ingrained in our tradition here. We all grew up with it. But drone light shows provide an excellent alternative. When I have to look at forums and they ask me for environmental impact, for me, it's very easy, right? There's no sound pollution. There's no chemical pollution. You know, even our entire operation is contained, so I don't even need access to power. It's interesting to see because when we've been at some of the shows, you know, people ask us, oh, you know, will it affect the animals at the zoo? How about these endangered white terns, you know, or even dogs, right? House pets. So fortunately for us, you know, they're not bothered by any of that. Pets love drones. My dog loves drones. She's a sweetheart. And interesting, you know, one of the things that I actually never really thought about before was the sound pollution with regard to people with PTSD. Mm-hmm. There was one show that we had, our first show out in Hawaii Kai, when somebody mentioned that, and they were actually very concerned. And I let them know, you know, there's actually not going to be any sound pollution, any loud explosions. We're just going to have a speaker set up over here so you can come and listen. And, you know, after the show, she was like, that was awesome. Thank you guys so much. Oh, my gosh. And it's things like that that really keep us and our team going.
So is there anything else that you want to add or plans for the company in this year?
You know, this year, I think we're just plugging along as we can. You know, a big thing that I'd want to get more people to see is just more public displays. Because once you see a drone show, you're going to want a drone show. Like that, I can almost guarantee. Like, the first show that we did, I just was looking up at them as they took off and making their formation. I was like, this is just so incredible. And having that production with the audio, it's crazy to see. It's like seeing something incredible for the first time, but almost every single time. Because for us, we can always change the show, right? It's never the same show twice. So you can have different audio track layered over the creative that you produce with the drones, and it's... Yeah, it's like a flying marching band. They can do everything differently every single time.
I love that. That's so nerdy.
Yeah, I mean, I was a huge nerd. I was a huge band geek, actually. My band director out there from Kalani really appreciates me using my marching band knowledge here. Thank you, Mr. K.
Tyler Hironaka, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you guys for having us. And, you know, I'm always happy to share more about what we do. As we go and do more things, I'll invite you guys to the next show.
That was Tyler Hironaka, NHPR's Maddie Bender, talking about drone light shows as an alternative to fireworks. This interview originally aired in February, and we reached out to Hironaka, who told us he's planning two shows for New Year's Eve. One will take place at the Kahala Hotel on Oahu, the other at the Westin Maui Resort and Spa in Ka'anapali. Head to our website after the show for more information. You know, a favorite childhood book of mine, The Giving Tree, came to mind as I learned about the passing of former University of Hawaii professor Tom Donnell. The founder of Trees for Honolulu's Future died this month at the age of 97. I thought of the book not just because of the tree connection, but because I learned of the deep roots that he set down in our community and the seeds that he sowed because he cared about where we live. He was the force behind the creation of the UH Urban Planning Department, and his students have certainly made their mark, with many serving as director of the city's planning department, George Atta, Kathy Sokugawa, and Henry Ng, to name a few. Even House Speaker Nadine Nakamura was among his students. We spoke with Donnell back in 2018. He talked about the mission of his nonprofit and some of his favorite trees. Here's a snippet of our conversation.
Our main streets are relatively bare of trees, so we have a ways to go. If you want a really good example of what trees can do, go to the Manoa campus. Even East-West Center Road and the Manoa campus has a median strip that is just has trees from the beginning to the end. And the campus is a certified arboretum. And that's why it's so important to involve the arborists and the people that know trees. And yes, it's, you know, it's true that some leaves will fall on the ground and certain trees are much more sloppy than others.
Okay.
And we'll want to avoid those.
Well, what's your favorite tree?
My favorite, maybe because we have it in our backyard, is a lychee tree that now is probably as old as me. And it isn't bearing fruit anymore, but it's sure giving shade and it's sure absorbing heat. And it keeps our home cool. And now I'm looking at it and it's kind of blowing in the wind, and it's a piece of beauty that makes our home even nicer and softens the lines.
And I'm sure you've lots of memories associated with that lychee tree, and you've probably eaten lots of lychee.
Yeah, in my youth I used to climb it and shake it so the kids could stretch a sheet below and catch the lychees.
All
but
right.
I don't do that anymore.
Okay. Well, the next time your tree bears fruit, save some for me, would you? And that was Tom Donnell, who we spoke to back in 2018. And I talked to Donnell's son, Dan, yesterday afternoon. We sat under the shade of a tulip wood tree out in front. It was a city tree that the city planted in front of the Donnell family home on Wilhelmina Drive, which is up the street from where I live.
Well, my parents arrived in Hawaii back in 1957 when it was a territory, and my dad was doing consulting work for the territorial government, and they liked it so much they just decided to stay, and he went on to work for the state and helped get the state budget process set up, and then the Legislative Reference Bureau, the LRB, and became the director of the LRB. Yeah, really goes back to the early days of statehood.
And he worked at Iolani Palace when it was the legislative offices.
That's right. After the palace got renovated, he'd love to show people around and say, this is where I used to work, here in the basement of Iolani Palace.
I have come to learn that many of his students are still doing his work in urban planning. We've had the previous directors of land use, the land use department.
That's right. If you ask my dad before he passed away, what his greatest professional pride is, it's not publishing a book or a paper, it's the students that he was able to mentor and teach, and their success, not only in government, as you point out, but in the private sector, in the nonprofit sector. And Catherine, not just in Hawaii, but on the U.S. continent and overseas as well. That brought my dad a lot of pride.
To think that he really started the Department of Urban Planning at the University of Hawaii. It was a program, and he developed it into a full-fledged department.
That's right. In the early 60s, he started it as a program and then became a department, and he served as department chair for a couple decades. I would always tell my friends who asked, what did your dad do? And I said, I don't know, he played tennis, because he would drop us off at school and then go and play tennis. But seriously, he did work very hard. And I think what really brought him a lot of joy was seeing that planning wasn't just about buildings and the infrastructure, but really planning needs to be about people, and there needs to be social justice and community building. And these were principles that my dad really felt strongly about and passed through to his students.
Yeah, when you think of urban planning, it's good design and designing around the community's needs. And the fact that so many of his students are still in key positions now to do that kind of work.
And one thing he would say is, too many cars on the road and those conveniences. But in all seriousness, planning's not perfect. Nothing is. And he understood there was that give and take. And his students understood that there was that give and take. And really what it's, as long as you had your values and your values stayed true, you would do okay. And I think that was one of his big lessons, life lessons, is if you encounter some difficulty, just take that deep breath and figure it out.
In his later years, he focused on trees, and, you know, you've taken up the torch just because of the need, and trees are just so integral to living here in Hawaii. And when you think about city living and the part that those trees play.
Yeah, absolutely. He actually was co-chairing Age-Friendly City with Mike Formby, now the city managing director. And he came to this realization, my dad did, that the future of Honolulu wouldn't be so nice without shade. It wouldn't allow particularly older people comfort as they move around. And he had this really big worry that people would get from their air-conditioned house into their air-conditioned car and go to the air-conditioned mall. And he didn't want to see that. And that's really the genesis for getting a small group of people together to create a movement where citizens would be demanding more trees in public spaces.
And I think when we consider the need and the loss of canopy, right, in the city. I mean, your dad really, he just knew that trees need to be an integral part of where we live.
Yeah, absolutely. When you think about everything they do for you in terms of cleaning the air, in terms of cooling, in terms of just adding beautification. And it's really epitomizes what my dad is all about, which is planting seeds for the future. So you see it in his students, you see it in the trees. And he worked, people don't know about a part of chapter of his life, it was a half dozen plus years with Catholic Charities, this idea of helping people through his faith and belief. And people think, oh, Catholic Charities only helps Catholics. That's not the case. It's really a social justice movement. And he really enjoyed that chapter of his life. And that, I think that's the thing for your listeners to realize is, here's a man who had many different chapters, and it's just wonderful. The trees are just the coda to it all.
Yeah, I just think he planted so many seeds when you think of his students and the work that they're doing in continuing to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. The students are his great professional joy. And on the personal side, I can say with some modesty, his family is his greatest joy. And not just his children, of which there are quite a few of us, but the fact that their grandchildren and great-grandchildren and his nephews and nieces, and it's just that brought him great joy as well.
Anything else that you want to leave our listeners with as we celebrate your dad's life and the mark that he left?
Yeah, I just want people to be thinking about how they can take small actions that make big impacts, because that really is my dad's core belief. One of my older sisters says, who in their right mind starts an organization at 88 years old? And the answer is Tom Donnell. So if your listeners want to do something, if they want to take care of a small part of their town, their city, they should do it. And they should do it with joy, and they should do it with a great deal of satisfaction. And if you live on Oahu and you want a street tree, you should contact the Division of Urban Forestry and they'll check out your street tree. And if it meets their specifications, or maybe even if it doesn't meet their specifications, they'll plant you a tree and you can take care of it. And then you've got that lasting legacy.
So while we sit under the shade of this fruit tree,
it's a tulip wood.
Tulip wood tree.
Yes. Okay, it's actually not a fruit tree because the city doesn't like to plant fruit trees on public property. It causes conflict. But okay. I wish it was a mango tree or a lychee tree. The other thing is trees need to be appropriate for this space. And yeah, a big fruit tree would not be appropriate in this particular space.
Yeah, it's the right tree in the right place.
Right place with the right care. And that's super important too, because people get excited about planting trees. Not a lot of people get excited about caring for trees, but both are necessary.
Yes, both are necessary, the care of our trees. We have been hearing from Dan Donnell, who was sharing his thoughts about the passing of his father, Tom Donnell. The founding chair of the UH Department of Urban and Regional Planning died at his home overlooking Honolulu. Tom Donnell was one of only 14 people from Hawaii elected as a fellow to the American Institute of Certified Planners. His last public appearance was earlier this year when he challenged participants to make Honolulu a city among trees. We should note that Trees for Honolulu's Future has helped with our backyard quiz giveaway this year. Look for links on our website later today to find out how you can sign up to care for a city street tree and be part of the movement that Tom Donnell envisioned for our Honolulu.
green's the color of spring. And green can be cool and friendly life.
HPR is celebrating the season with special programming on HPR 1 and HPR 2. See the full lineup at hawaiipublicradio.org/holiday. Sponsored by Maui Fruit Jewels as a gift to the community.
It's almost time to say hello to 2026, so we're diving into rituals performed around the world to bring good fortune in the new year.
At midnight, you grab a suitcase, an empty suitcase, and run outside.
That's what you do if you want to travel, but what if you just need plain old good luck? Find out next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
You know, it was just a little more than a year ago that Cirque du Soleil's Oana opened at the Outrigger Beachcomber Hotel in Waikiki. The idea was to combine Cirque du Soleil's world-famous acrobatic and athletic performances with Hawaiian storytelling and dance. Aaron Salah is the cultural creative producer for the show and had a major hand in its early development. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson checked in with Salah recently to ask about this first year and to find out what we can expect in the future.
It's been amazing, you know, upwards of quarter of a million tickets sold over the course of the year. So really, really very excited about that. And as is really, you know, local Hawaiian style, the fact that we were able to celebrate 1 year, I think is something for all of us to be really very proud of.
Yeah, I remember speaking with you when the show was just coming together and there was a certain sense of pride in putting it together. But there's something different when it gets out into the world and that engagement is kind of where the actual art is made, right? That exchange with the audience.
You know what's been really fun? I'll tell you, every person that I've come into contact with that has gone to see the show, local families, visitors alike, everyone is really surprised, I think, by how impactful the show is. And so I think my favorite thing is to hear when local families go and local families feel this sense of pride in product, pride in ownership of a thing that we put before the globe, as it were. Really very proud of that, I have to say. And the quality of the engagement with visitors who come, who want to come back. We've had visitors often enough for us to really think through this, ask about the potential of an annual pass to come and see Awana, which is itself, you know, sort of outside of my own thinking about what the show was, but that the show has been impactful enough that people want to come back again and again. I got to say, it has surprised me and also provided an opportunity for us to think about, okay, what is it that we did really well here and how do we replicate it? How do we do more of it?
Right. I mean, that's an interesting question. To me, that says that people are experiencing the show beyond that first engagement and it's sitting with them for a bit, right? And moments are sitting with them and they're processing the show.
Yeah, I think that's part of it too, is one of the things that we said coming into the show is that, you know, there's 32 cast members on the show, on the stage over the course of the evening. And we talked about the opportunity for someone to follow one dancer from beginning to the end of the show, what that dancer does in the first vignette and then the second vignette, how that is used to transition into the third vignette, etc. You can follow one dancer, or you can follow the storyline, or you can just choose to be free in the moment and go where your eyes wander, where your senses wander. And so I think every time someone comes to watch the show, they are inspired perhaps or impacted by something different, which again goes to a testament to the power of Cirque du Soleil, that is a global performing arts platform, and the marriage of Cirque du Soleil with Hawaiian story, which is compelling at so many different levels. So lots to see, lots to engage in every single time you go.
I remember as the show launched, some of the creative team talked about wanting to keep it fluid and leave room to make adjustments and changes. Has that happened? Have changes been made over the year?
Absolutely. The show that we opened with, in very nuanced and profound ways, in all honesty, has changed over the course of the year. We've had to make adjustments in obviously, when someone is not well, we have to cover for that particular act. We onboard new acts. And so there are opportunities for us to constantly look at and be nimble about the creative process and how the creative process is expressed in a show like this. I'll add to that piece as well, that as we've onboarded new cast members, both front stage and backstage team members, the Cirque and the entire team has been really committed to assuring that everyone that comes into the project is grounded in a local and a cultural way. And I think what that's done is build a sense of, pardon me, but ohana, a sense of family that I think is impactful for anyone that comes into contact with the show. Whether you come to see the show as an audience member or you come to be a part of the show as a member of the cast and the crew. And so, you know, the opportunity then for the show itself to be nimble and to move as we need it to move or to move as itself feels the need to move, I think is part and parcel of that.
And on that point of cast, you told us about the size of the cast and you indicated there that you've had some turnover. I mean, I think that audience members who might come to one show and experience that magic might underestimate what a challenge so many shows a week can be. Talk a little bit about that grind and introducing new cast members. Is that something you have done a lot of in the last year?
Yeah, we haven't done it too much. Thankful that, you know, a lot of the crew members, a lot of the cast has become territorial, has become really committed to this particular show. We're thankful for that. That said, it is tremendously daunting on the body to continue to do all the kinds of things that we require in a production like this. As a Cirque du Soleil show, it does not disappoint. But as you can imagine, you know, even on days off, we have cast members coming in to train. They're training, and then they're rehearsing, and then they're warming up for the show. And then they're probably training as a down, you know, to bring their bodies down after the show, training just a little bit more. And that's a day in, day out activity. And so, you know, just assuring that the bodies stay fit, you can't let too much time pass between training days, then making sure that the timing of warming up into the moment that you're on stage and then how that moment then, you know, dissipate when you're done on stage is all critical to maintaining physical and mental health. In saying that, I'm just thinking about the quality of the commitment of this cast and crew to assuring that an audience member gets everything that they hope to get and more in the experience itself of the production.
That's the beauty of performing live theater, isn't it? That's the beautiful challenge, is to remind mm-hmm. yourself every single time you go out there. You might have done this hundreds of times, but for almost everybody or everybody in the audience, it will be the first, maybe the only time.
You know, just a note on that, one of the fascinating things to me is if a show doesn't go as perfectly as planned, perfectly as intended, those moments that make the shows really individual, maybe, you know, one of the tricks doesn't fall, you know, in complete sync with the music. The opportunity then to say that happened and that gives this show a particular individual signature, we let that moment be gone and we look forward and we make sure that the next moment hits. It's something that I just, every time I see the show, the quality and the level of the professionalism of our cast and our team is something to really have gratitude and appreciation
yeah.
for.
Yeah, it's such a great point. And it is the magic of live theater. We've all seen the same show in a sense. And on the other hand, none of us have seen the same show. It's been different every night.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly it.
I want to ask one specific cast question. The Trickster, a beloved performer, has there been a change in the casting of that role, or is there some switching out going on there? Because I know I've seen a few different performers do that.
Yeah, so we make sure that actually we have coverage for every single act. Trickster is one of those acts, so we have several layers of tricksters that are able to do the work if we so
Great.
Need.
Awesome. And so I know when the show began, there was a lot of desire to make sure there could be engagement in the community, even outside of the theater space, engagement with students in schools and so forth. Has any of that been able to happen, or is that something that you're still envisioning?
Yes, and both. So that has happened over the course of the year. And also we are looking at maintaining, or I should say, building into it. So we've had the cast in Lo'ikalo. They've gotten their feet literally dirty, learning about Hawaiian ways of planting and growing kalo. We've taken the team out to schools, primary and middle schools. And so we do want to lean into that more in the coming year. So be on the lookout for more of that activity.
Anything I haven't asked you about that you just would want listeners to know about the show or share with listeners about Awana as we reflect on the first year of performances?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity and thank the community very much for the support that the community has shown. If you haven't seen Awana, I do very highly encourage you and challenge you really to make your way down to Waikiki. It is an incredible show, and it isn't what makes it incredible for me is the opportunity for our own community to take ownership of the kind of work that this is and the kind of opportunity to storytell about Native Hawaii, about local Hawaii to a global audience. And so thank you for that opportunity. Aloha.
That was Aaron Salah, cultural creative producer for Cirque du Soleil's Awana. He was talking to HPR's D.W. Gibson about the show as it has marked its one-year anniversary. And full disclosure, Outrigger Hospitality Group is an HPR underwriter. Well, that's a wrap for today. Tomorrow, we ring in the new year and we take you to one of the last performances of a free hula show in Waikiki. Share your comments or questions about what you heard on the conversation by calling our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.